content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 6, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Greece's revolt against austerity. What happened? Greek voters sent shockwaves through Europe this week, electing into parliament a left-wing party whose fierce opposition to austerity policies set the nation on a collision course with Germany and the European Union over the terms of its national bailout. Harnessing a public backlash against years of job losses and economic hardship, the Syriza party came just two seats short of an overall majority. The party's firebrand leader, Alexis Tsipras, was sworn in as prime minister after forming an unlikely coalition with independent Greeks, a far-right party with similar anti-austerity goals. Tsipras insisted that his country would not default on its debts and lead the euro, but repeated his determination to renegotiate the terms of Greece's $270 billion bailout. The verdict of the Greek people ends, beyond any doubt, the vicious circle of austerity in our country, he said. Syriza's victory was celebrated in Athens by crowds of tens of thousands of Greeks, who were joined by Italian, Tunisian, and Spanish leftists waving red flags, a sign of how broad the anti-austerity movement has become in Europe. Athens' main stock market tumbled by 6.4%, reflecting investor fears. Greece's biggest international lenders, the so-called Troika of the European Union, the International Monetary Fund, and European Central Bank, remained adamant that the country would pay off its debt, which currently stands at 175% of GDP. There are rules, there are agreements, said German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble. Whoever understands these things knows the numbers, knows the situation. What the editorial said. The message from Sunday's elections in Greece was unambiguous, said the New York Times. The Greeks cannot and will not continue to abide by the austerity regime that has brought their economy to its knees. Who can blame them? Under the Troika's savage budget cuts, Greece's GDP has shrunk by a quarter and unemployment has risen to 25% and 50% among young people. Starving Greeks now forage through garbage cans for food, while suicides have soared. Those who insist the Greeks deserve their punishment for years of profligate public spending need to realize that crippling an economy is not the way to enable a country to pay back its debts. Syriza's victory puts German Chancellor Angela Merkel in a real bind, said the Los Angeles Times. Any concession made to Greece would probably be demanded by every other bailed-out country in the Eurozone, including Spain and Italy. But if Germany and the other major lenders don't offer any concessions, then Athens will almost certainly default. That would likely lead to Greece's exiting the euro, the much-dreaded Grexit. What the columnist said. The Troika's belief that Greece could impose draconian budget cuts with little effect on growth or employment was fantasy economics, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. By choosing to believe the myth that the private sector can always make up for any public spending shortfall, these supposedly hard-headed officials have created an economic and human nightmare. The problem wasn't the medicine, it was the patient, said Bert Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. Corruption and cronyism are so ingrained in Greece that setting up a profitable business is almost impossible. The Troika should cut its losses and force the Greeks to return to the drachma. That would at least send a strong warning to the rest of Europe's lackluster reformers. No one with any sense wants a Grexit, said Martin Wolf in the Financial Times. It would render every future Eurozone crisis a potential exit moment, creating chronic instability. That's why Germany and other creditors have no choice but to swallow their pride and write off some of Greece's debts, preferably in exchange for fiscal reforms. Economics aside, Syriza's victory may mark the start of a political revolution in Europe, said Leonid Bishitsky in BloombergView.com. Anti-establishment parties with big, simple ideas, leave the EU, say, or halt immigration, have been tearing apart centrist political duopolies from Madrid to London to Paris. By proving it's possible to win elections, Syriza could invigorate extremists throughout the continent. And we have a second main story today. Obama pays tribute to Saudi alliance. What happened? In a strong show of support for a key U.S. ally, President Obama this week led a 30-member delegation to Saudi Arabia to pay respect to the late King Abdullah bin Abdul Aziz and meet the kingdom's new monarch, Abdullah's half-brother, King Salman. The bipartisan delegation was filled with high-level Washington figures, including Secretary of State John Kerry, who was joined by two of his predecessors, CIA Director John Brennan, Republican Senator John McCain, and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Before traveling to Riyadh, President Obama defended his decision to show solidarity with a government that rules under strict Sharia law, routinely beheads criminals, treats women as second-class citizens, and punishes displays of dissent with public lashings and long jail sentences. Sometimes we have to balance our need to speak to them about human rights issues, said Obama, with immediate concerns we have in terms of counterterrorism or dealing with regional stability. Abdullah's death prompted an immediate shakeup in the sprawling House of Saud. King Salman, 79, who has already suffered at least one stroke, issued a decree confirming his half-brother, Crown Prince Mukrin, 69, as his successor. The country's 55-year-old interior minister, Mohammed bin Nayef, was named deputy crown prince and second in line to the throne. The first time a grandson of Saudi Arabia's founder, Abdul Aziz, has been added to the line of succession. What the editorial said. Obama was right to honor Abdullah, said the Washington Post. Conservative as he might have been by Western standards, the king helped modernize his hidebound and autocratic monarchy. He eased restrictions on women entering education and the workforce, and at the time of his death, women accounted for half of all Saudi college graduates. Abdullah also furthered U.S. interest in the region, proposing a landmark plan for Arab peace with Israel and waging war against Islamic extremists, both at home and abroad. That doesn't mean we should ignore his regime's many crimes, said The Economist. A Saudi blogger last month received the first of his 1,000 lashes for writing an article promoting atheism. 3 days later, a woman accused of murder was dragged through the streets of Mecca and beheaded with a sword. Saudi women are so oppressed that they still aren't allowed to drive, and King Abdullah primed young men the world over to join al-Qaeda by bankrolling the export of his country's extremist Wahhabi form of Islam. Perhaps it's time America reconsiders its cozy relationship with Saudi Arabia. What the columnist said. King Salman is starting his job on one hell of a week, said Joshua Keating in Slate.com. Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor, Yemen, is hurtling towards civil war after Iran-backed rebels toppled its government. Meanwhile, to Saudi Arabia's north, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria continues to grab more territory. With Salman apparently mentally infirm and his successor Mukrin far from sprightly, said Karen Elliott House in WSJ.com, the future of the kingdom rests with Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed. His hardline record as interior minister suggests more repression, but he has also encouraged the rehabilitation of young jihadists, offering them a car, a job, and a wife if they convincingly recant terrorism. U.S.-Saudi relations will remain strong regardless, said Andrew Studdiford in NationalReview.com. Saudi Arabia is a repulsive theocracy, a cesspit where self-righteousness and corruption walk well hand in hand, but it's also one of the only Middle Eastern countries that hasn't fragmented or fallen prey to jihadist groups like ISIS, and one of the few willing to contain America's longtime foe, Iran. But that alliance could be about to face its greatest test, said Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com. Pressure is growing on the U.S. government to release the famously redacted 28 pages of the 9/11 Commission report. Those pages, which were missing from the congressional report when it was made public in 2004, are rumored to detail how high-ranking members of the Saudi government provided a network of support for the 9/11 hijackers. If the report really is damning of Saudi Arabia, as insiders say it is, then Iran is probably going to start looking pretty good to most Americans by comparison. Our controversy of the week, the Middle East, Boehner and Netanyahu's power play. It has to be one of the most ham-fisted, irresponsible, and potentially dangerous political stunts ever engineered, said James Zogby in HuffingtonPost.com. Republican House Speaker John Boehner announced last week that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had accepted his invitation to address a joint session of Congress on the need for new sanctions against Iran. In an unprecedented breach of protocol, Boehner did not clear the invitation with the White House. Netanyahu's decision to accept is a stunning show of disrespect to Obama, with whom he has openly feuded over U.S. Middle East policy. Boehner and Netanyahu clearly hope to sabotage the Obama administration's delicate negotiations with Iran on its nuclear program. As a secondary benefit, Israelis will see their controversial prime minister getting a standing ovation from Congress just 2 weeks before the country's elections. There are things you simply don't do, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. Boehner is now actively siding with a foreign leader against the president and openly working to undermine U.S. foreign policy. At the risk of sounding overly dramatic, I don't think this has ever happened before. Some things are more important than diplomatic protocol, said Mark Thiessen in TheWashingtonPost.com. Iran's nuclear ambitions represent a gathering threat to Israel's very existence, and Netanyahu has good reason to be worried about the weakness of the deal Obama is bent on striking with Iran to help distract attention from his failed Middle East policy. The people of Israel will have to live with the consequences long after Obama's gone. This isn't about politics for Netanyahu, says Izzy Leibler in jpost.com. Bibi is just trying to fulfill what he sees as his sacred task to prevent a global catastrophe and existential threat to his people. Every Israeli prime minister has two sacred tasks, says Jeffrey Goldberg in theatlantic.com. keeping Israel safe is the first, and the second, because the first depends on it, is staying on the good side of the president and the people of the United States. Netanyahu has just decided, in effect, to spit in Obama's face and to align Israel with just one of the U.S.'s political parties, the Republicans. This reckless display of Netanyahu's contempt for Obama threatens the bipartisan nature of Israel's American support, forcing American Jews and Jewish Democrats on Capitol Hill to choose between their president and Israel's president could have terrible consequences for Israel. Totally alienating Obama is just as dangerous. I am an ardent supporter of Israel, but I am also an American, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. It disturbs me to see Netanyahu brazenly insult Obama this way, even if I share the Prime Minister's distrust of Obama's backbone. It's also foolish for Netanyahu to align himself with the older, largely evangelical, and fiercely pro-Israel base of the GOP. That alliance may feel comforting now, but it may come at the price of alienating younger Americans and Democrats who already are dismayed by Israel's white right-wing lurch under Netanyahu's leadership. Think also of what this does to the American system of government, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. Under our Constitution, it's the president who is the commander-in-chief. He sets our foreign policy. It weakens our nation substantively and in the eyes of the world for Congress to invite a foreign leader to embarrass the president on U.S. soil. Given that one day Democrats will again control Congress while a Republican sits in the White House, Boehner may be setting a costly precedent. Well, it was a good week for takeout after residents of Cardiff, Wales selected The Clink, a prison-based restaurant staffed by inmates, as the city's top eatery. It was a good week for Fido and Fluffy after the National Retail Federation said Americans would spend an estimated $700 million on Valentine's Day presents for their pets. And it was a good week for Nine Lives after a Florida cat returned to his master's house 5 days after being, quote, killed in a car accident and buried. Despite multiple injuries, Bart managed to claw out of his grave. This is unbelievable, said owner Ellis Houston. I don't have any explanation for it. But it was a bad week for Sarah Palin, who launched into a rambling, incoherent rant when the teleprompter malfunctioned during her speech to Iowa Republicans. Conservative attendees called the speech bizarre and coarse, while NationalReview.com said Palin had collapsed into self-parody and ignominious pasquinade. It was a bad week for privacy after Illinois schools launched an anti-bullying campaign by requiring that students under suspicion provide teachers with all their social media passwords. It's a tragic example of government overreach, said the ACLU. And it was a bad week for believing in medical studies after a Harvard research used a random text generator to write a phony study and had the gibberish accepted for publication by 17 medical journals. The study's title, Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. But it wasn't all bad. Priscilla Sentinai is living proof that no matter your age, it's never too late to learn. The 90-year-old Kenyan never had a chance to go to school as a child, but she was so determined to learn to read and write that she enrolled in a local elementary school where she now studies math, English, phys ed and drama alongside several of her great-great-grandchildren. I want to inspire children to get an education, Steinai said. Too many older kids are not in school. They tell me they are too old. I tell them, I go to school, and so should you. On the briefing page, supersized. Over the past half a century, the NFL Super Bowl has become America's true national holiday. Just how big is the big game? By almost every measure, the Super Bowl is the single most popular sporting event in America today. More than 112 million people tuned in to last year's game, making it the highest-rated television program of all time. Over the past 10 years, Super Bowl broadcasts have enjoyed a larger average audience than the World Series, NBA Finals, Stanley Cup Finals, and Academy Awards combined. And those numbers are likely to increase. With the exception of 2013, when the audience was only 108 million, Super Bowl viewership has grown every year since 2005. NBC expects this year's audience for the game between the New England Patriots and the Seattle Seahawks to surpass 115 million. It would be a huge disappointment if we weren't the most watched show in the history of television, said Fred Godelli, NBC's coordinating producer for Super Bowl 49. But what truly sets the game apart is the fact that most people tuning in, an estimated 52%, aren't even football fans. The biggest thing about the Super Bowl, said Godelli, is you have people watching football for the only time this year. Why is that? Since it was first played in January 1967, the Super Bowl has grown from a mere sporting event to a true cultural phenomenon. The festivities surrounding the game, from the fighter jet flyovers to the halftime spectaculars to the post-game presidential phone calls, have imbued the game with a larger-than-life significance. The Super Bowl has created a convergence of sports, politics, and myth, said Joseph L. Price, a religion professor at Whittier College in California. Like festivals in ancient societies, which made no distinction regarding the religious, political, and sporting character of certain events, the Super Bowl succeeds in reuniting those disparate dimensions of social life. Price wrote those words in 1974, when the Super Bowl audience was just 50 million people, less than half of what it is today. Why does everybody watch? Partly because it's an excuse to eat and drink as if you're at a Roman bacchanalia. The National Retail Federation estimates that Americans will spend more than $12 billion on food, drink, game-related merchandise, and electronics, including 7.5 million new televisions for the game day. In all, 1.2 billion chicken wings, 79 million pounds of guacamole, 32 million slices of pizza, and 11.2 million pounds of potato chips will be consumed on February 1st, and it will all be washed down with some 50 million cases of beer. As for the after effects, antacid sales spike 20% the day after the game, and 7 million people call in sick. How did all this get started? Rather humbly. In the mid-1960s, the American Football League was making a serious challenge to the NFL, signing away top draft picks as well as lucrative broadcast deals with the TV networks. In classic, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em fashion, the leagues agreed to a merger. And in 1967, the NFL's Green Bay Packers defeated the AFL's Kansas City Chiefs in the aptly named AFL NFL championship game, subsequently dubbed Super Bowl I. Credit for that now infamous moniker goes to Chiefs owner Lamar Hunt. "I have kiddingly called the game the Super Bowl," Hunt wrote to then NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle in 1966, "which obviously can be improved upon." Will the Super Bowl keep growing? The NFL certainly thinks so. Commissioner Roger Goodell has said the league, which is considering putting new franchises in Europe, expects to more than double its overall revenue to $25 billion by 2027. But pro football faces a serious threat to its popularity and its ability to keep attracting players: head injuries. By the NFL's own estimate, nearly 30% of NFL players will suffer from Alzheimer's disease or some other form of early-onset dementia as a direct result of playing football. And the damage may start to occur long before players reach the pros, as some studies have found signs of brain trauma in high school players after just one season. Participation rates in Pop Warner, the country's largest youth football organization, fell nearly 10% from 2010 to 2012. Just last week, former player and coach Mike Ditka said that if he had an 8-year-old son today, he would not allow him to play football. "I think the risk is worse than the reward," Ditka said. "I really do." So far, however, the brain trauma issue has not hurt the NFL's wild popularity, nor has the domestic violence scandal that erupted earlier this season. "It's been a year that the NFL, in many regards, would love to forget," said NBC's Al Michaels, who is calling his 9th Super Bowl this year. "I think the fans can compartmentalize this, compartmentalize a lot of this." And now a word from our sponsors, an inset in the article about the commercials. A 30-second commercial in this year's game sold for an average of $4.5 million, nearly double what it cost just 10 years ago. Why are the advertisers willing to fork over such huge sums for Super Bowl airtime? One reason might be that it's the only television broadcast where ratings actually go up during commercials. People watch because advertisers and advertising agencies pull out all the stops to make funny, shocking, or otherwise memorable Super Bowl ads that will create buzz for their products. And there is plenty of anecdotal evidence that Super Bowl spots can have a huge impact on a company's bottom line. Automaker Audi has doubled its market share since its first Super Bowl ad in 2006. While Anheuser-Busch routinely sees a spike in Budweiser sales in the weeks following the game. Newer brands get an even bigger boost. After airing its first Super Bowl ad in 2012, the sneaker company Skechers increased sales 26% and tripled its stock price over the next 2 years. "It's a statement that we're playing serious," said Daniel Birnbaum, CEO of SodaStream, which aired its first Super Bowl ad in 2013. "It has opened doors for us." Take a look now at the columns. We'll take two of the best columns from the U.S. to start with. The first comes from Jamel Bowie at Slate.com. "Republicans discover inequality." With another presidential election on the horizon, Republicans are finally tackling income inequality as a national problem, said Jamel Bowie. Presidential hopeful Jeb Bush has already said he plans to focus on middle-class economic security, noting that a recovery that's been great for top earners has done nothing for the rest of America. Mitt Romney, the same plutocrat who disdained the 47% of takers, recently said he'd focus his next presidential campaign on poverty, complaining that under President Obama, the rich have gotten richer and income inequality has gotten worse. Obama and the Democrats already have staked out middle-class economics as the primary issue of the next election cycle. And though Republicans are a little late in discovering the problem, their participation in the conversation is a welcome change. If they're sincere, conservatives can provide a valuable perspective on how best to address the stagnant incomes and poor job prospects of the middle class and the working poor. Only if both parties see growing inequality as a real issue will it ever get successfully addressed. And from Francis Wilkinson at Bloomberg.com, when guns don't make you safe. In just the last week, a 5-year-old shot and killed his baby brother, and a 2-year-old shot himself with his dad's gun. Some Americans may consider such tragedies as an acceptable price for the right to bear arms, said Francis Wilkinson. But why do so many gun owners keep loaded weapons in their homes and cars? In pro-gun states, carrying a loaded weapon has now become a political statement, a badge of cultural authenticity, and an upraised finger to the jackboot of authoritarianism. To boost gun sales, the National Rifle Association has embarked on a campaign to foment fear, warning members to arm themselves against rampaging carjackers, rapists, and home invaders. Crime is actually at historic lows. But in the NRA's paranoid worldview, only a gun can keep you safe from the snarling monsters waiting to burst through your door. Perhaps that's why Veronica Rutledge of Idaho recently brought a loaded handgun on a shopping trip to Walmart, where her 2-year-old reached into her purse and pulled the trigger, killing her instantly. Keeping loaded guns at the ready makes people feel safe. Until a family member falls dead. And this from Argentina, the mysterious death of Alberto Nisman. A prosecutor is dead, and the government is hurling wild accusations, said Mariano Obarrio in La Nación. Alberto Nisman was the prosecutor investigating the 1994 bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires, which killed 85 people and was widely believed to be the work of Iranian-backed Hezbollah agents. He recently claimed to have evidence that President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner tried to cut a secret deal with Tehran, offering immunity to Iranian officials implicated in the bombing in exchange for oil. But just hours before Nisman was due to testify against the government, he was found dead in his home of a gunshot wound to the head. Kirchner immediately took to social media to spin the story. At first, she said it must be suicide. After police cast doubt on that theory, she alleged that a former intelligence official, Antonio Stiuso, had fed false information to Nisman to discredit the government, a plot that somehow ended with the prosecutor's murder. There will be no charges against Stiuso, though, because there is no evidence to support the president's claims. It's classic Kirchner. Deny everything and change the subject, said Ricardo Roa in Clarín. She gave her speech dressed in white, seated in a wheelchair because of her broken ankle, trying to come across as a victim. In another country, a president would not interfere in a crime investigation. But Kirchner cast herself as detective and already has a prime suspect. She claims that Diego Lagomarsino, a colleague of Nisman's who lent the prosecutor the gun that killed him, was a known opponent of her government. To her, the world is full of treacherous spies allied with prosecutors and the media. It's the allegations against her government that are preposterous, said David Kufra in Paginals 12. Nisman vastly overstated the importance of the alleged Iranian trade deal. Frankly, there's no reason why we couldn't trade Argentine grain for Iranian oil, without a secret pact. But in any case, Iranian crude isn't particularly useful for us because it is not compatible with Argentine refineries. As for the other side of the alleged deal, the dropping of international arrest warrants against Iranian suspects, Interpol has confirmed that Argentina never requested this, and the warrants remain in effect. One thing is clear in all this muck. Argentina desperately needs a wholesale reform of the Secret Services, said Federico Poor in the Buenos Aires Herald. Kirchner called for such an overhaul in her speech this week, and it's important she get it right. Our spy chiefs still operate as they did during the dark days of Argentina's military dictatorship and have no respect for our elected leaders. What we need now is not a mere shakeup of top leaders, but rather a comprehensive, democratically minded reform of the intelligence sector. Our column, The Last Word, this week, our in-depth column, is called Hands Off the Wheel. I, quote, drove a car from San Francisco to Las Vegas, said Alex Davies, and saw the future of the car. I was a few hours outside of Los Angeles, tooling down I-5 at the wheel of a sleek Audi A7 on a gorgeous day, when a little girl in an SUV smiled and waved. I waved back with both hands. This immediately freaked her out, and she started jumping up and down. All I could do was laugh, knowing my vigorous wave was in no way a safety hazard. In fact, I hadn't touched the steering wheel in more than an hour. What that little girl didn't know was that I was piloting Audi's latest autonomous vehicle, a prototype designed specifically to handle the monotony of highway driving. I was riding along on a road trip from Palo Alto, California, to Las Vegas, where Audi was showing off autonomous tech that may be in showrooms by the end of the decade. If this A7, nicknamed Jack, wasn't advertising Audi-piloted driving on its side, you'd never know it wasn't just another German sedan. All the gadgetry that keeps it centered in its lane at precisely the speed you select is discreetly incorporated into the car. It's top-end stuff, too. 6 radars, 3 cameras, and 2 light detection and ranging units. The computers that allow the car to analyze the road and choose the optimal path and stick to it fit neatly in the trunk. It's remarkably smooth, maintaining a safe following distance, making smooth lane changes, and politely moving to the left to pass slower vehicles controlled by carbon-based life forms. It's so sophisticated that I never felt anything unusual. And in fact, the car is designed to reassure you that you need only grab the wheel or tap the brake or immediately resume control. And that's the most remarkable thing about Audi's robo-car. All that tech recedes into the background. Driving this car is mundane, almost boring. My interaction with that little girl was the most exciting part of the trip. They don't let just anyone behind the wheel of an autonomous car. California and Nevada, 2 of the 4 states, and Washington, D.C., that have adopted regulations governing autonomous vehicles on the road, have reams of rules that must be followed. One of them dictates that anyone who gets behind the wheel must be properly trained. For Audi, this means learning to be a better-than-average driver. The way Audi sees it, anyone given the responsibility of piloting this device on public roads had damned well be up to the task of taking over, because if you need to grab the wheel, the odds are something's gone terribly amiss. A nicer way of saying this is it takes a lot of skill to be better than Audi's robot. I was trained at Volkswagen's Proving Grounds outside Chandler, Arizona. VW is Audi's corporate parent. This is where VW puts its cars through hell, tuning them and adjusting them on a high-speed oval, a pair of smaller tracks, and an outrageously bumpy stretch of road. There's even a huge shallow pool and a dirt oval, which would probably be lots of fun in a VW GTI. After an orientation session and a dreary office, we headed for the track. VW's instructors, who have forgotten more than you've ever known about driving, led me through a slew of exercises in a GTI that's been driven hard. I had to drive a slalom, then drive it in reverse. I mastered emergency braking and evasive turning and skid recovery. They even made me hone my parking skills. It was a day-long lesson in fundamentals that everyone ought to master before being issued a license. It also was, for the most part, a blast. Once everyone was confident I knew what I was doing, I was taught how to operate the autonomous A7. This took all of 5 minutes. Basically, you wait until the car's system determines it's safe to turn on autopilot, meaning you're cruising on a highway and not near an exit or entrance ramp. Then you press 2 steering wheel mounted buttons simultaneously and let go. It couldn't be easier. Much like the car's exterior, the interior appears utterly stock at first glance. But little things identify it as something special. A small screen below the main infotainment screen tells you when the piloted mode is available, when it's active, and when it will be shut off, and when it will shut off. A line of LEDs stretches across the dash. The lights change color to pass along similar info. They glow bluish-green when the car is doing the work, yellow when it's time to resume control, and red when you are in command. To communicate the transfer of responsibility to the autonomous system, the steering wheel retracts a few inches. It's just far enough to make it clear you are no longer in charge, but close enough to grab if things go sideways. Because Highway Pilot is for highway driving only, the car makes it abundantly clear when you need to resume driving when, say, the highway ends or your exit approaches. 15 seconds before the transfer, the bluish-green LEDs turn yellow, and a voice tells you autopilot will be turned off. 10 seconds before the transfer, the LEDs turn red, and the steering wheel extends to meet you. If you fail to respond, the car activates its hazard lights and slows to a stop, moving to the shoulder if possible. Turning off piloted mode is easy. Hit 2 buttons on the wheel, press the gas or brake pedal, or grab the wheel with a bit of force, and you're in control again. It's just that fast, and it's remarkably sophisticated. Drumming your fingers on the wheel, perhaps out of boredom, doesn't do anything, but even the slightest turn will shut off piloted mode. I was supposed to take the autonomous A7 out for a few laps on VW's high-speed oval, but a technical glitch sidelined the car. We were halfway to the hotel when the engineers solved the problem. They hopped in and met us on the road. And so it was that I found myself behind the wheel of an autonomous vehicle for the first time. I wasn't confined to the safety of a track, but on a busy street, among real people in real cars, at night. The issue here is the street has traffic signals, which the highway pilot system is not programmed to recognize. You don't see a lot of traffic signals on I-5 or I-10. So I used piloted mode for cruising along, then reverted to manual mode when approaching intersections. Project leader Daniel Lipinski suggested I let the car do all the work, since it is programmed to maintain a safe following distance and avoid hitting anything in front of it. Audi's engineers hadn't tried this before, but Lipinski had enough confidence in the tech to let me be the first to test it. Damned if it didn't work at the next light, bringing the car to a safe stop 2 car lengths behind the guy in front of us. "We didn't know it would do that," Lipinski said with some excitement. That hammers home a fundamental point about autonomous technology. It is remarkably advanced, yet still in its infancy. It works very well, yes, but we don't really know exactly how well. And it may, for better or worse, very well surprise us with what it can do. Every decision the car makes comes down to two questions. Is it possible, that is, safe and legal, and is it beneficial, that is, does it make the ride more comfortable? Tuning the system to assess the balance, these two things, and speed up, slow down, change lanes, or make turns smoothly, has been key to developing the technology. At one point during my drive, the A7 moved effortlessly into a relatively small slot in the right lane to make way for a faster car approaching from behind. It was seamless. That kind of decision-making and maneuvering is quite advanced, yet needs fine-tuning before commercial production can begin. As my excitement turned to boredom, I-5 just goes on and on and on. It became easy to see Highway Pilot as a feature drivers will embrace. And it suggests Audi and other automakers are on the right track, rolling out autonomous tech one or two features at a time. Knowing I can immediately resume control of the car and feeling a conventional steering wheel in my hands and pedals beneath my feet makes the transition to being chauffeured by a robot easier to embrace. It's a more sophisticated version of the adaptive cruise control we're already using. In that way, the A7 isn't a self-driving car. It's a luxury sedan that can, with my approval, make driving safer, easier, and more relaxing. A piecemeal approach also is easier for automakers and regulators. Making one swift jump to fully autonomous driving, as Google is pursuing, requires perfecting all of the technology and considering every possible scenario. The car must know exactly what to do everywhere under every condition. It's a massive undertaking, and it's easy to see why the automakers want to take things one step at a time. Shortly after crossing into Nevada, we pull over and swap the license plates, because California and Nevada have different rules regulating autonomous vehicles. It underscores why Audi and other automakers want to see the feds take the lead regulating such cars. The patchwork of rules is, at this point, one impediment to marketing Highway Pilot. There are other challenges to marketing this tech, not the least of which is packaging all the sensors and computers. Consumers don't want a car that looks like it was used to rob a Comp USA. Each of the 8 PCs in the back of our A7 serves a different function. They control data logging, planning a path, steering, braking, and acceleration, operating the near-field camera, and fusing sensor data. When it's time to go to market, Audi will consolidate these functions into a single computer called the ZFAS. 2 years ago, the ZFAS filled the trunk. When Audi rolled into CES last year, it was a bit smaller than a shoebox. By the time Highway Pilot sees production, it will be the size of an iPad. After the drive from Silicon Valley to Vegas, the car feels ready for showrooms, but Audi says there's more work to do. The rules that govern how the car adjusts its speed and position need more fine-tuning. For example, the Audi team has put some 50,000 miles on the Highway Pilot feature and will rack up many more before going public. From deer to sinkholes, highways hold a lot of potential hazards, and the system has to be prepared for them. During my time at the wheel, I never needed to take control from the car, except to take an exit. I turned the system on and off to get a feel for how it works, but I felt the need to grab the wheel only once, and only then to accommodate the Audi camera crew in a passing car. The photographer wanted me to move into the right lane. The lane change would be safe, yes, but not beneficial because it would put me behind a lumbering truck. The car didn't see the logic in that, so I grabbed the wheel, put on my turn signal, and changed lanes. It was almost as exciting as spooking the girl in the SUV. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Wired.com. Over on the health and science page now, are there two more planets? New data suggests there may be two undiscovered planets lurking on the outer fringes of our solar system. Astronomers at the Complutense University of Madrid have detected curious abnormalities in the orbits of a belt of icy rocks at the edge of the solar system, far beyond the orbit of Neptune, the eighth and final known planet. In 2006, Pluto was demoted to a dwarf planet. These so-called trans-Neptunian objects should have fairly specific recognizable orbits, but 12 of the objects have very unusual orbits, evidence astronomers say that they may be under the gravitational pull of unseen planets. Our calculation suggests that there are at least two planets and probably more, astronomer Carlos de la Fuente Marcos tells TheGuardian.com, but he cautions that his team's theory remains speculative and that much more data must be gathered. The two unseen planets couldn't be much bigger than the Earth, or they would have been observed by now even at their great distance. If two additional planets are found, said De La Fuente Marcos, it would be truly revolutionary for astronomy. Healthcare, the health scare of the week, the dangers of sitting. Want to reduce your chances of dying early? Get off your butt. A comprehensive analysis of 47 studies examines links between sitting and mortality has produced a definitive conclusion. People who sit most of the day have an increased chance of developing diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, and tend to have shorter lifespans. Researchers from the University Health Network of Toronto found that those who sat for long periods were 24% more likely to die from health problems than those who sat less. They also established that while exercise helps, it cannot completely counteract the negative effects of sitting. The study authors didn't determine exactly how much sitting was too much, but suggested that exceeding a total of 8 hours a day could lead to an increased risk of health problems. Lead researchers Avirup Biswas advised people to get up from their chairs or couches as often as possible. When you're sitting, think of ways to stand, he tells LiveScience.com. Move as much as you can when you're not exercising. And a related article, The Benefits of a Lunchtime Stroll. If you often feel tired and lethargic after lunch, here's some advice. Take a walk. A new study has found that even a gentle lunchtime stroll can result in significant and immediate improvement in energy and stress levels, the New York Times reports. Scientists have long known that walking is healthy for both body and mind, but until now, studies have focused largely on its long-term effects. In a new study, British researchers at the University of Birmingham gave 56 sedentary but healthy office workers a simple exercise regime, walking for 30 minutes at lunch, three times a week, at whatever pace they wanted. The volunteers were then asked to answer a series of questions every afternoon to determine their mood. At the end of the 10-week study, the results were striking. The volunteers felt markedly more enthusiastic and less stressed on the afternoons when they had walked. Study leader Dr. Cecile Thorgerson-Natumi noted that while many employers expect their employees to work through their lunch break, people who get out for a walk would be happier and more enthusiastic, and therefore more productive. On the Talking Points page, American Sniper, a political message? What does it say about Americans, said Lindsay West in TheGuardian.com, that they're making a hero out of an unapologetic racist who took pleasure in dehumanizing and killing brown people? Clint Eastwood's American Sniper, which raked in $107 million at the box office last week, a record for a film opening in January, is based on the life of the late Chris Kyle, the deadliest sniper in U.S. military history. 160 confirmed kills, another 95 probables, who wrote in his memoir that killing was fun and called Iraqis savages about whom he couldn't give a blank. Eastwood's film scrupulously sands off Kyle's edges to make him more sympathetic, said Alyssa Rosenberg in WashingtonPost.com. In Kyle's memoir, he makes it clear he saw Iraqis as evil subhumans and boasts of not only killing them by the score, but of driving remote-controlled cars at crowds of civilians for what he called the priceless amusement of hearing their high-pitched screams. Chris Kyle wasn't a saint, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com, but his unshakable belief in the rightness of his mission made him an exceptional warrior and a true American hero. To the left, of course, that clarity of moral vision reeks of backwardness and jingoism, which is why the rapturous reception for American Sniper, particularly in the nation's heartland, has liberals seething. It's Kyle's lack of remorse for all the lives he took that's really making heads explode on the left, said Rebecca Cousy in TheFederalist.com. But there are bad guys in this world. And Kyle killed suicide bombers and jihadis who planted homemade bombs in the road to kill Americans. A warrior has to do his job, and it's a noble job. To do that job, it's necessary to dehumanize the enemy, said Mitch Leitzman in StarTribune.com. When I was in Afghanistan, I killed to protect myself and my comrades. And the only way to keep myself sane was to turn off the emotion that would come from actually killing another human being. This emotional distancing makes serious mental toil, however, especially when it comes to rejoin civilian life, as American Sniper accurately depicts. That's not a conservative message or even a liberal one. It's a sobering reminder why we must be truly judicious with the application of force. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.